It's a very thick coffee in order to chew it.
Oh, it's a very intense coffee. I've been writing about Spanish lattes, which are espresso, condensed milk, and foamed milk. And I made a version of them for us yesterday, and it was very good.
And now, because it's been a long week, and we're at the end of the week and we're recording, that's what we're drinking
that's
today.
That's what we're going to have. So if we end up talking very quickly, now you know why. Welcome to the Generally Spooky Podcast.
Welcome.
This is episode 5.
Yep. Episode 5, baby.
And we are recording ahead of time, as we've said. So it's a snowy April day here. We're a week out from launch. So hopefully you'll be listening soon.
Less than a week. The podcast launches in less than a week.
We're excited and we're scared. We hope people are listening and that you guys like it.
I'm terrified. I had a freak out yesterday.
You did.
Because I realised it was a week. And I'm not even, we're not even nearly where I hope we would be.
Yeah. It'll be fine.
I hope so.
It'll be fine. But if you have been listening and enjoying, please leave us a review, wherever you can review it on
please.
Your podcast player.
It really helps.
Yeah.
You don't even know. Like, I didn't even know. But it really, it really helps.
It does.
So like, if you're sitting there and you like it, don't keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Don't tell us.
Tell us. Tell your friends.
Tell people.
Tell your nan.
Tell the people. The people have to know.
The people do need to know. And again, I have quite a blocked nose, so I apologise if I sound quite nasally.
You've had a blocked nose like all week.
I think
it's
been
a week of a severely blocked nose.
Yeah, I think I had it in the last episode too, because I made the same disclaimer. Allergies, man. We're into spring. But it's snowing. What's that about?
You've got the worst of everything. You're cold. You have a really blocked nose. You can't go outside.
It's bullshit.
Yeah, it sounds like bullshit.
We'll get by, though. We'll hang in there.
Okay, well, today I want to put out a disclaimer from the very beginning, because today's story is a lot gorier and, in my mind, a lot scarier than the other stories we've told so far.
That's exciting.
So, if gore isn't your thing, if you're easily startled, like a little deer, you know... It happens. This isn't the episode for you.
Mm.
And I'm not going to be offended. If this isn't for you, look after yourself. Just miss this episode. We'll see you next week.
You can pass.
That's okay. Totally fine. I'm not going to judge you. It's scary. This is the spook.
This is the spook we all signed up for.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready.
Well, it's a little bit of a callback to our very first episode.
Ooh.
Which is exciting. A little bit of nostalgia now. Ooh. That we're halfway through.
Nice callback.
In our first episode, we talked about the fairy coffins that were discovered in Edinburgh. Do you remember?
I do remember.
If you haven't listened to the episode and don't want any spoilers, stop here and go listen to it.
Yeah.
Or just skip ahead like a minute or two from here. If you don't want it spoiled. But you should really go listen to the episode. It's our first one. It's cute.
We tried, okay?
In the episode, we talked about some theories about what the coffins were.
We
did. And why they were put there. And one of the theories that I brought up then was how it was extremely coincidental that there were 17 of these little coffins and that the infamous Burke and Hare had killed 17 people in Edinburgh.
Yep, that was the accepted theory of the Old Edinburgh Club, I think. Is that what they were called?
I can't remember if that was their theory, but we did talk about them.
I don't
want to say that's their theory and then it's not. They might get me, Kieran. They might get me.
They know where to hide all the bodies.
They might get me. So today, we're talking about Burke and Hare.
I'm ready.
Are you, though? I don't know if you are.
Murder me up, girl.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just wow.
We got too impatient, though, because we asked in the first episode that if you, the listener, want to hear that, then let us know. But it's not out yet, and now we're doing it, because I wanted to hear it. I listened.
You were pretty pumped when I brought up that I could do this. Was it last week?
Yes.
So you were pretty excited.
Yeah. I think it's going to be fun. You berk.
You were soon going to discover that berking has a very different meaning than what you think.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Interesting.
I feel like this is the most famous story that we've covered so far. I think this is the most well-known.
I feel like I just got clickbaited. Birking's not what you think it is. Oh. Click here to find more.
Not intentional, but yeah. Yeah, you did. But, you know, I think you'd struggle to find someone who hasn't heard anything about Birkin here.
Yeah, I think so.
Of all the stories that you find in Scottish history, this one has really gotten around, and lots of people know it.
Yeah, of what we've done so far, I think that's fair to say. It's not Jekyll and Hyde. I keep confusing that in my head.
No, well, maybe once you've heard the story and you know it a bit better, you'll be able to differentiate.
Yes.
But yeah, I'll say again now that we're here, this is a gory story. If you don't like gore, if you're easily scared, genuinely, this probably isn't going to be the episode for you. We try to mix up the stories we tell, so there's something a little bit different each episode. This is the first time we're really discussing things like murder.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll probably be talking about something different next week. But yeah, just duck out of this one if it's not for you. Look after yourself and we'll see you in the next one. That's totally fine. Anything you'd like to add, sir?
No, I'm hyped now. I'm expecting it to be horrible.
Really?
Yeah, so.
Good.
So if it's not, good,
because it's horrible. There are horrible details. Horrible.
Horrible. I'm convinced it's not going to hear me.
So let's start by setting the scene, shall we?
We can do that.
Once again, we're in Edinburgh.
Ugh.
The Scottish capital. It's 1828, so we're back in the 1800s.
Okay.
For possibly the third time.
Yes.
Third or fourth time.
Because the Flannan Isle lighthouse was finished in 1897. So I'm going to test. And I think.
Well, I mean, you just listened to the episode. You just edited it. So you probably know more than I do.
Possibly. And then.
I know it was the 1890s, but I couldn't tell you the exact year.
I think it was 1897 or 1899. And then. The fairy coffins were found in, 1850?
Well, the fairy coffins, they haven't been discovered by 1828. They won't be discovered until 1836.
Oh, earlier than I thought.
King William IV is king. He's the king of Great Britain and Hanover. He is the penultimate Hanoverian king. Queen Victoria comes after King William IV. And King George IV... was before King William IV. I'm not giving you any chances. None. I checked.
That's me told.
So there.
King William IV.
Mm-hmm.
Hanoverian.
Yeah. I think that's... I'm opening myself up again here, but I'm pretty sure the Hanoverian line is to do with when King William of Orange came over and took the throne. I really don't know my monarchs very well, but I checked this time. I know who's king currently, who was king before, and who was queen after.
So what eye colour does King William have?
Brown.
What's his inseam length?
Why do you want to know his inseam? You creep.
Just seemed more out there than his outseam.
His outseam. Once again, we're at a time in history when medicine is advancing really, really quickly. Discoveries are being made all the time, and the profession as they knew it then was changing really quickly. And a lot of it was happening in Edinburgh.
Mm.
It was a hub for medical science. Along with, there was a city in the Netherlands that I can't remember the name of, and somewhere in Spain, or Italy. They were considered the three hubs of medical science.
Modern medicine.
Mm-hmm. As they know it back then. Yes, so a lot of it was happening in Edinburgh. Alexander Munro was the first to provide detailed studies of the musculoskeletal system.
Hmm.
So he was a big part of developing how we understand how our bones, our muscles, our ligaments, our tendons, how they all work and how they work together.
Did he make the song?
I don't think he made the song.
Your hip bone's connected to your leg bone. Was that him? Is that how we know?
John Bell is considered as being one of the founders of surgery as we know it, concerning the vascular system.
Hmm.
So your heart, your circulations, your vein, your circulation, your veins, all that good stuff. He developed a lot of the knowledge in that area, and he was also based in Edinburgh. Sir James Young Simpson developed and started using chloroform as anaesthesia for the first time in 1857.
Oh, God. So, I mean, there was no anaesthesia before that.
Yeah, can't imagine operations were much fun.
Ooh.
I think they might have used other forms of anaesthesia, but he started using chloroform.
Oh, God.
And found it was effective. But, yeah, not a good time to need your leg chopped off or anything like that.
No. I do remember, it might be in Master and Commander. It really freaked me out because I saw it when I was quite young. Because there's someone gets their leg blown off by a cannon. And so they have like, oh, we have to amputate it. And they just gave him a big bit of leather to bite down on.
They basically just saw bits of you off.
Yeah.
And really.
Had at you.
Oh, but you know, if it's that or death.
That's true.
You know.
Better than gangrene, probably.
Still horrible, but, you know, when the choice is that or death.
Oh.
I should also say just now that Dr. Joseph Lister had the amazing idea to use antiseptic during surgery. At this time. That wasn't done before. So, you know, we're at a time in history where you're just starting to get anaesthesia and just starting to have clean operating tables.
Oh.
That's fun.
Well, yeah, because you didn't have to wash your hands until, like, sometime in the 1900s, doctors started washing their hands.
I think it was, like, the early 1900s. It was, and even then, it was kind of new science. Some people didn't subscribe to it for a long time.
Yeah.
It took a while to convince people that it was something you had to do.
Oh. I just... Oh, I can't even imagine. Put your cigarette down, carry on with your operation.
My stepdad had a dentist who used to do that.
Oh.
He was a smoker. He would, like, have a cigarette in between appointments and he wouldn't wash his hands. And then he would do dentistry.
Oh my God.
He remembers that as a kid. As a kid. Right? But you know, it's easy to take these things for granted now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But someone had to come up with the idea and the concept of cleanliness and anaesthesia and understanding how the body worked. And that's what these men were doing. And I say men because only men could study medicine. It was actually only men who could go to university at all until 1869, when the Edinburgh Seven began studying at the University of Edinburgh to become doctors. And they were the first female undergraduate students across the whole of the UK. And we can talk about this another time. It's a different story. They had an awful time. Yeah, just sucks. Awful.
Horrendous.
But for now, medicine is advancing and there are lots of doctors and professors and lecturers who are at the front of all of this and think that they're amazing. Unfortunately, there is one rather important necessary tool required for the teaching and learning of anatomy. Can you guess what that might be?
Is it a cadaver?
Yes, bodies. They needed bodies. In order to study anatomy, people had to see it. And the only way they could see it was if it was cut open and presented to them. They had to know how it worked. They had to know what they were dealing with. So the people who were teaching medical students needed bodies that they could dissect in surgical theatres. And we have a different idea in our heads of what an operating theatre is today. But back then, it was pretty much an actual theatre.
I've seen pictures of them and things. Mm-hmm.
So bodies were dissected in front of all these students and they were taught about the human body and how to work on it. And at this time, the bodies that they needed for the study were in pretty short supply. And there were a few reasons for this, which I've looked into. The current law, as of 1828, because it changed a lot. As medicine progressed over the past like 100 years, the law changed several times as to what was allowed in terms of studying dead bodies. But in 1828, there were only a few groups of bodies that a medical lecturer could legally use for a dissection. They were allowed to use the bodies of people who had died in prison.
Oh.
So they were fair game. They were allowed to use the bodies of people who had committed suicide, because suicide was viewed as an ungodly sin.
I was wondering if it would be all the sinners' bodies they'd be allowed to use.
Well, yeah, that's two of them. Mm. But the last one was they were allowed to use the bodies of foundlings and orphans.
No.
So that's nice, isn't it?
What's a foundling?
Foundling, like, I think it's if a child is, like, abandoned.
Mm.
An infant that has been abandoned by its parents and is discovered and cared for by others.
Oh.
So, not the same as an orphan, because a foundling could have parents, but they've abandoned their child.
Go ahead. Yep.
Basically. Yep. So, yeah, they were totally fine. Totally allowed.
Ew.
You think this is bad? It's only getting worse from here.
I was wondering, I'm listening to Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology, and talking about Hel, who guards the underworld, and all the people who go to Hel, and included women who died in childbirth. That was one of the groups that weren't deemed worthy enough to go to Valhalla. So I was wondering if that was going to be on your list there.
Well, wasn't it only people who died in battle who could go to Valhalla?
Yes.
It was like warriors' heaven.
Yeah.
Or heaven was for warriors.
Yeah, because it was the people who died of old age, suicide, women who died in childbirth.
So like I said, the law had changed quite a lot in the run-up to 1828 when our story starts. Back in 1752. In 1752, a law was introduced that is actually called the Murder Act. I'm not even kidding. And they basically introduced this to try and make criminals more afraid of committing murder.
Which always works, eventually.
I know. There was a rise in murder cases at the time, and people or lawmakers were trying to find ways to discourage people from murdering people. So the law said that after you were caught and charged for murder, the mandatory sentence for that was already death.
Mm-hmm.
There was like 200 different offences in England at this time that you had to be killed for.
Well,
I had to be. There was no other sentence. If you were found guilty of this, you had to be executed.
Ooh.
So you had to be executed if you were murdered someone. But this law said that after being executed, you would either be dissected or gibbeted. And gibbeted meant being hung 30 feet in the air from a set of chains in some kind of public forum, and you were just left there to rot.
Oh.
It sounds medieval, but this was 1752, and this was legal until 1832. Not that long ago.
Not that long ago. Not long enough ago.
The law also said that you wouldn't get a burial if you were charged with being, or convicted of being a murderer. And your execution had to take place 2 days after you were sentenced.
Hmm.
So nowadays, when you look at the US and things, there's some death row prisoners that are there for years.
Mm-hmm.
But this law said you had to be executed 2 days later.
Jeez.
Unless it was a Sunday. Then apparently is wrong. But this meant there was basically no time for any kind of pardon to come through or any kind of appeal. Like, that was it.
Wild.
Yeah.
Just no chance at all.
Not really. Not in 2 days.
If you're guilty, you're guilty. I can't imagine it being the most just justice system.
Well, I mean, standards for evidence and investigation were just different because the methods were different.
Yeah.
Dissection was much more common for the people who had been executed as murderers rather than being gibbeted. 79% of those who were sentenced to death with post-mortem punishment between 1752 and 1832 were dissected as part of medical science. But I think it's skewed because only men could be gibbeted. So if you were a woman and you were sentenced to death, you could only be dissected. You couldn't be gibbeted as a woman.
That was simply too much.
I know. I don't really know if that's better or worse.
I don't know.
I really don't know.
At least you get some usefulness out of you after death.
Yeah. But even with this steady supply of murderers and orphans, doctors and lecturers were still struggling because there was a rising popularity to study medicine. So more and more students were coming in, but the supply of bodies just couldn't keep up. I'm pretty sure I read in one source that each medical school across the UK was only allocated the body of one executed criminal a year.
Hmm.
So that's all they were allowed in terms of executions.
It's not a lot to teach with.
No. I'm not sure how accurate that is because I only saw it in one place. But basically, they just didn't have enough, even with all of these lovely laws in place to ensure that things were terrible, basically.
I remember reading a letter from a doctor. It was online somewhere, and it was either a doctor in the 1800s or the 1700s that they'd written to a friend talking about just how awful it was because they didn't make any money and they were about to be homeless, and it was just this horrible profession to be in, and saying, like, no one should do this. It's the actual worst. Because I was comparing it to modern doctors in America more.
Pretty thankless.
Yeah. And just sounded horrendous. Like, oh, wow, that's such a high esteem career now.
For some, I think being a doctor or working in healthcare is still pretty thankless, to be honest.
Well, yeah.
You don't nearly get enough.
Oh, I was thinking in America, because you can make a butt ton of money.
I guess, but that's a very flawed system. We can't get into the US healthcare system today, no. So we're in the 1820s. And there's this shortage of bodies. And it happened kind of because of that. A huge craze had overtaken Edinburgh. And this craze became everyone's big fear. And that was grave robbing. The medical professionals were so desperate for bodies to study that they were paying really good money to anyone that could bring them a body in decent enough condition that they could dissect it. So there was a lot of money to be made in bringing bodies to the doctors.
Jeez, oh.
Yeah. And lots of people in Edinburgh wanted part of this money, because, you know, it's hard to make a living. A lot of people were living in poverty. You bring a body, you get paid for it.
Yeah, if there's money to be made.
Exactly. So they were turning to the graveyards and the kirkyards around the city, but they were looking specifically for the people who had been recently buried, so they could dig them up and take them to the dock. And they had to be recently buried, because if they were too decomposed, they were worthless.
Mm.
you can't teach much with that. You can't show much with that if it's all rotted away, basically. And you would actually make more money selling a body to the lecturers in the wintertime than you would in the summertime.
Huh.
Because the weather was so much colder, bodies could be stored much more efficiently. So you would make more money in the winter. So yeah, grave robbing, it became a huge problem across Edinburgh, and loads of protests were held by people because they were outraged that their loved ones were being stolen.
Yeah.
And their eternal rest was being disturbed and then taken away. But there were some people that were selling their loved ones' eternal rest away themselves so that they could pocket the money from their dead relative.
Seems like immoral. There's part of me like, oh, how could you do that? But if you're living in poverty, that could mean you can feed and heat yourself for the winter.
Well, if you imagine yourself as, you know, like a middle-aged person, you have 7 children, you've just lost your elderly aunt or father, you know, you could see how people would be tempted because your children could be starving.
Yeah. Just needs must.
So it's distasteful, but to a point, in some cases, you could probably understand it.
Yeah, I think so.
But there were some people who were just robbing all graves.
Mm-hmm.
And that was widely disgusting to everyone in Edinburgh. Like, you shouldn't be doing that. So a lot was done to try and make the cemeteries more secure and to provide some kind of protection from these grave robbers. You can still see some of them now, but across some of the graveyards in Edinburgh, watchtowers were built. So there are these little, like, turret-shaped buildings at the gates of cemeteries.
Oh, hell.
And in some cases, guards were hired to stand in the watchtower and watch the graveyard at night to make sure that nothing was taken. Some wealthy families hired stone slabs, these giant stone slabs, to be put on top of their loved one's grave until the body would be worthless and wouldn't be a target anymore.
Jeez, oh.
And they just hired the slab. So at this point, the slab was taken away and someone else hired it for the same thing.
We watched that ghost tour of Edinburgh. Who did that again?
The Deathly Tours, the Dark Deathly Tours.
Yeah, David Deathly.
Mm.
Deathly Tours.
I can't remember the name of the tours, though. We can link it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll look it up. They did a really good thing, and they were in one of the graveyards in Edinburgh, showing the, like, iron bars that were over the graves.
Well, I'm just going to get to that, actually. Mm. That's one of the measures that was taken to protect the graves. So, these things, they look kind of like metal cages placed on top of graves, and they were called mort safes.
Oh.
So, they basically just lock down the grave so that the body couldn't be disturbed or like nothing could be taken. Some of the really wealthy families actually hired guards themselves to stand over the grave. So not just in the watchtower, it was to stand by the grave itself.
Wow.
But some families who didn't have that kind of money just took shifts themselves to stand over the grave and keep people away.
Oh, man.
So they were really going to extreme lengths. It seemed like it was a genuine fear and something people were really, really worried about.
Imagine being, like, trying to grieve because you've just lost a loved one and then having to contend with this as well. And then being like, oh, well, at least once we do this for 3 weeks, or I have no idea how long it would take, then we get to stop and then we can start moving on.
Well, see, people were especially frustrated because the laws that surround grave robbing were really strange and there were lots of loopholes.
Mm.
So disturbing a grave at all was a crime. You could be charged for doing that, for disturbing a grave. Even if you didn't take anything, messing with a grave was a crime. If you took any valuables out of a grave or a coffin, that was also a crime, because that's theft.
Yep.
So stealing jewellery, things like that from a grave, you could be charged. But if you steal a body, that's not a crime.
Huh. So you can steal from the body. Sorry, you can't steal from the body.
No.
But if you take the body, you're fine.
The body is arguably the most valuable thing in there. But if you steal the body, that's not a crime. Because technically, it didn't belong to anyone.
Well, it's not kidnapping, really, is it? Yeah.
No. It doesn't belong to anybody. So it's not stealing.
Interesting.
So the families were really pissed because there's this huge loophole that meant that the people who, if they were doing it properly, and a lot of them were, they weren't going to be charged for it because technically they hadn't done anything wrong.
You know, it's bad, but technically,
I know,
technically,
I know. Anytime you have to say it, it's just, you know that something's dodgy.
Yeah. You say technically to just appease your own conscience.
Yeah. The people who robbed graves for bodies were given the nickname the Resurrection Men, which is awful.
No.
But over time, by the time that we get to 1828, the Resurrection Men were having a much harder time stealing bodies because all these measures had been brought in, people were much more vigilant, they had come up with ways to stop graves from being robbed. So the Resurrection Men had a harder trade, and the medical lecturers were really suffering because they weren't getting these technically legal bodies anymore.
It's too much to cope with.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
And in 1823, judges were granted the power for the first time to decide whether a criminal should get the death penalty or not. So remember I said there were like 200 offences that had to be charged with execution? Judges finally had the power to decide if that person really deserved the death penalty. So there were fewer executions.
Ooh.
So again, less bodies. So yeah, I know that took a while, a lot of information about law and grave robbing and everything, but you kind of need to know that to understand Birkenhair's place in our story.
I think it'll be interesting.
It just kind of sets the background for what's about to happen. So, enter Birkenhair. There was a lot of similarities between Birkenhair, like even before they met each other. They were both originally from Ireland. And both of them were called William.
Huh.
Their names were William Burke and William Hare.
Oh, yeah, because I joked about them being the Billies.
Yeah. By all accounts, from everything that I read, Burke had a pretty good life in Ireland. He was born in 1792, and his parents were reasonably well off. They weren't struggling for money. And he had joined the British Army with his brother, Constantine, and had served in the British Army. He came home. He got married, he had two kids, and like things were pretty unremarkable and pretty good.
That is not the backstory I expected.
Right. But then he got into a barney with his father-in-law. There was some kind of dispute over land, and instead of working it out, Burke left the country. In 1818, he moved to Scotland.
And nope.
Yet he left his entire family. He left his wife, he left his kids, and he would never see them again.
That's a hell of a dispute.
Mm-hmm. All I could find was that it was a dispute over ownership of land. There was no specifics.
Well.
But he left.
Huh, that's odd, to say the least.
So he got a job working on the Union Canal, which is a canal further down south in Scotland that has the Falkirk Wheel as a part of it.
Oh, yeah.
He was working on that canal. He even met a new woman, and her name was Helen McDougall, but he called her Nellie. And they lived together as if they were husband and wife, but they never actually got married, because Burke had a wife.
Oh, so he didn't get divorced, so they couldn't get married.
Yeah. And he had children that he just abandoned.
Oh.
So I think I read it, it's like common law, husband and wife, so they didn't actually have a marriage ceremony, but they lived as if they were married.
Oh.
So the two of them, they lived in Falkirk for a bit, but then they moved to Edinburgh, to Tanner's Close. And they worked as hawkers for a little while, so they sold clothes and things on the street and moved around to try and sell it. But then Burke became a cobbler, so he made shoes.
Oh.
But yeah, knowing who he is now, it's a bit odd, but Burke was pretty well liked by everyone who knew him.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, reports from around Edinburgh say that he was a good laugh, he was a nice guy. You never saw him without his Bible in his pocket.
Oh.
Like, he was pretty well respected, which just goes to show you can't trust anyone.
I think that's always much more unsettling. Like, the guy who Zac Efron's playing in that new movie.
Ted Bundy.
You hear about him being, like, a nice guy and having all these friends and being just fully functioning human, seemingly.
Well, he seemed, again, we can't get into Ted Bundy because I'll talk for like 3 hours, but he seemed that way, but he wasn't.
Well, yeah, which is obviously the same with Burke. Just, well, because, yeah, Burke's pretty sound. Comes into my shop, we chat, he's nice. Always see him with his Bible, great. And then at night, he's up to no good.
Up to nae good. So that's William Burke. Hare, again, it's a similar story. He was originally from Ireland, but nobody was ever sure how old he actually was. Reports say he was born somewhere between 1792 and 1804.
Okay.
So he was either the same age as Burke or a bit younger. And he also worked on the Union Canal for about 7 years, the same place that Burke worked. So there's a chance that they would have met each other while they were working there. And then he also moved to Edinburgh.
Hmm.
But he stayed at a lodging house, which lodging houses at that time, they were kind of, they weren't hotels. They weren't always particularly nice places to live. It's basically somewhere to stay if you couldn't afford somewhere for yourself.
Kind of a more permanent hostel.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. And this lodging house was run by a woman called Margaret Laird. And this lodging house was also on Tanner's Close, which is where Burke lived.
Hmm.
Margaret Laird's husband died in 1826. And it wasn't too long after that that she and Hare got together. And they also lived as husband and wife without actually getting married.
Oh, that's pretty weird.
Do you see the similarities
here? Yeah.
It's so strange. So she went by the name Margaret Hare, but they never, ever got married.
Huh.
But Hare didn't have the same type of reputation that Burke did. He was not widely liked. He was known for being violent. And he apparently had lots of marks and scars on his face from where he'd gotten into fights in the past. And he was very quick to argue with people. He was quite volatile. And it seems like the type of person that you meet where you say the slightest thing wrong that they don't like and he would, like, jump down your throat. That type of person.
An arsehole.
Yes. Which I feel comfortable saying about people like Burke and Hare. That's fine.
Yep.
A man called Brian Bailey wrote a book about Burke and Hare. And in it, he called Hare amoral.
Okay.
And he also talks about Margaret, and he refers to her as hard-featured. And I don't really know what that has to do with anything. Like, by all accounts, she was not a nice person. Fair game. But I always find it interesting where you get the comparisons between how men and women are described and things like this.
Yeah.
What on earth does it have to do with anything that she was hard-featured?
Hard-featured. Hmm. That's weird.
So it's got nothing to do with anything, but I read it and was just like, what? Why is this here?
Just be like Stephen King, hard feature, then just start describing her breast. I'm like, why are you doing that?
Don't get me started on Stephen King. So it's 1827, and Burke and Hare are kind of on each other's periphery. Like, they've had a very similar life journey. They're living very close together. So it's kind of inevitable that they're going to meet and they're going to have a lot in common.
Yeah.
And Burke and Nellie meet Hare when they're all working on the harvest that year out in Midlothian, so outside the city. They meet for the first time and they become friends really, really quickly.
You would, having that much in common?
Once the harvest is finished, once they've finished working, the three of them all come back to Edinburgh, and Burke and Nellie actually move in with Hare and Margaret in their lodging house.
Ooh.
So, like, they're living sort of together as friends, but it's also a lodging house, so like they have a room.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it's great, but when you know what happens later, this seems like a ticking time bomb.
Yeah. Lodging house, not a lot of money.
And you see the disaster coming.
Ugh.
On the whole, Hare and Margaret's lodging house was pretty successful, but like I said, like, lodging houses weren't always the nicest places, so the people who were staying there usually weren't in the best situation, or they weren't very well off. Like, nobody who was staying there was loaded in any way. It was basically just a roof over their head. And where are we? Yeah, there's lots of conflicting reports, but most of the timelines that I saw agree that Burke and Hare started their grisly journey together in 1827, in November.
Okay. What's the last date we had for reference?
I mentioned 1828. So most of the murders happen in 1828. We're right at the end of 1827.
Got you. Ooh.
Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
So Hare and Margaret were playing host to a lodger whose name was Donald, and I couldn't find a surname anywhere. That's a recurring thing, by the way. A lot of the people in this story don't have names or are referred to by three different names across different documents and stuff. It's difficult to keep track. I've tried my best to keep the name just consistent. I've just kind of gone with one and stuck with that name.
Okay.
But I'm aware that sometimes they're called other things.
That's fine.
But yeah, Donald was a pensioner. He was living on his army pension and he was staying in the lodging house. So they had a range of people living there. Some people would stay a few nights while they were in the city. Some people might stay for months or years, depending on what their situation was. So it could be a temporary stay. It could be somewhere that you're effectively renting to live. And he'd been there for a while. Donald owed Hare and Margaret £4 of back rent, which is equivalent to about £440. So he was in debt.
Yep.
And he was waiting for his pension to come through. He got his pension quarterly. So it wasn't the weekly system that we're kind of familiar with in the UK now. He got it 4 times a year. And he was waiting for this quarterly pension to give Hare the back rent. But Donald wasn't very well. He was suffering from a condition called edema, which basically means that he was experiencing a lot of fluid building up in his body.
Ooh.
It's really nasty. I had to look into it so I could understand it. It's just not nice.
Mm.
You generally get like really swollen feet or really swollen ankles. And if it starts affecting your lungs or your brain, it can be fatal.
Oh, God.
Which seems to be what happened to Donald.
Mm.
He died at the lodging house.
Poor Donald died.
Yeah, poor Donald. Now, you can imagine what it must be like to be the owners of a lodging house and coming across a guest in that kind of condition. They're dead. You're shocked. You're overwhelmed. You're sorry of the poor fate that has fallen on this man. In Burke and Hare's case, they were quids in. They were over the moon. Because Hare had been complaining to Burke about Donald's debt for a while. And unfortunately for Hare, Donald had died before he got his pension payout.
Hmm.
How dare he?
I know, right?
How dare he die?
So inconsiderate of him. I have the Folly Towers episode in my head.
Oh.
Where they have a dead body in the hotel.
I hadn't thought of that.
Comically putting it around the hotel, trying to put it out of the way. So this is a kitchen, you can have it in here.
Well, they were not that concerned.
Probably not that.
Now that Donald was dead, there was no one looking for him. He didn't really have a family. He didn't have anyone who really cared. So the two men came up with the brilliant idea to sell his body to the university.
Genius.
And then they would get money back to make up for Donald's debt.
It's only fair. Right? It's the right thing to do. They're not going to pay for his funeral.
So they went through the usual motions like they were supposed to. They alerted the people they should have that there had been a death. And they were given a coffin that Donald was to go into for him to then be buried. So that was all fine, and they did this with the greatest respect. Until everyone left. And that's when they replaced Donald's body with a whole bunch of bark. So they filled the coffin with bark, and they hid his body under a bed. And they resealed the coffin, and no one was any the wiser. The coffin was picked up, it was collected, nobody suspected a thing, and then when it got dark, the men took Donald to the university. And they used a tea chest to stash his body, which is kind of like a crate-type looking thing.
Okay.
So that they didn't get any awkward questions on the way to the uni, they stashed the body.
Just under a bed. Huh, no one will look under here.
Well, why would they? They thought the coffin was full.
Yeah, but where else would you?
Right? When they reached the uni, they asked a student for directions, because they were looking for Professor Monroe, who I mentioned earlier. He had discovered a lot about the musculoskeletal system. So he was a well-known name. People knew who he was.
He wrote the song.
He did not write the song. But what I can only describe as like a weird twist of fate, the student sent them to the wrong place. The student sent them to Dr. Knox's surgery, not Professor Monroe. And that's how Knox's name gets brought into this whole case and is linked with these murders forever.
Interesting.
Basically. They were never supposed to see him that night.
Wow.
Now, Knox was another big name in medical circles, but I didn't mention him at the beginning because I didn't want to spoil it. But he was known as the most entertaining lecturer. So going to one of his lectures or one of his dissections was a real spectacle. And he was very popular for that reason. He qualified as a doctor in 1814. Yep. So he'd been on the go a while. He knew what he was doing. And he even served in the Battle of Waterloo as a medic in 1815. Oh, wow. So like, he knew his stuff. So the men arrived at Knox's door by accident, but they still had Donald's body to sell. Naturally, as is the way with very important people, Knox barely had to speak to Burke and Hare, because he had assistants to do that for him.
Naturally.
Right? So the men became very familiar with one of Knox's assistants, a man called David Patterson, and he spoke with Burke and Hare often over the course of the next few months, and he helped negotiate the price that Dr. Knox was willing to pay for these bodies. What I will say, though, is that Knox always had the final say for what he was willing to pay for a body. So he knew when a body was brought, and ultimately he got the final say. So it wasn't just the assistant. Knox knew that they were coming.
Mm-hmm.
On this occasion, Burke and Hare were given £7.10 for Donald.
That's quite a lot. I was wondering how much they'd get for a body. And the debt was £4?
Yes. So this was worth about £650. Which is no small amount if you don't make a lot anyway.
Yeah. And I imagine money went further.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a body.
Ugh.
Hare took a slightly bigger share than Burke because he had to cover the debt that Donald had left. So it made sense. It was fair. But both of the men left the university that night, having made a good amount of money for very little work. They didn't really have to do anything, and they were given this money.
Yeah. More than they ever would have made selling shoes.
Mm-hmm. So this is a bit of a spoiler. but later Burke would give a full confession of everything that he and Hare had done. And he talks about this night in his confession, and he says that David Patterson, the assistant, told them, quote, "they would be happy to see them again when they had another to dispose of," unquote.
Oh, that's a meaning weird another way body. To put it.
So, you know, it wasn't explicitly said, but there was kind of an understanding, kind of a, well, if you have another one, come here first.
Yeah.
You know, if you happen to find another one, you come here.
Ooh.
You know? But they never actually said anything.
No, no.
Which kind of leads me to this moral grey area that the doctors and the lecturers seem to be living in. And I'm interested to hear what you think, especially here, before we get into the stuff that's more distasteful. The Devices and Wiltshire Gazette wrote about Burke and Hare after the murders, but they also mentioned Knox and his practice for buying bodies. And they wrote, "not a single question was ever put, or if ever mere mockery, to the wretches who came week after week with uninterred bodies crammed into tea chests, but that each corpse was eagerly received and fresh orders issued for more." Which kind of sums up how I feel about it. It was, they never asked because they didn't want to know.
Well, yeah, they don't want to be fully culpable. Like, oh, they're just bringing bodies. Mm-hmm. And we're doing this, like, God's work of science. And we're saving lives for these bodies with our wonders as doctors. Ooh.
Because, you know, at this point with Donald's body, Knox hasn't really done anything wrong. Like, he's just buying a body of a person who died of natural causes. But he is leaving the door open for things to happen in the future.
Yeah.
So it is a moral grey area.
Absolutely. And it's hard to imagine that buying a body is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm like, well, that's really weird, you're buying a body. I'm like, oh no, if that's, at the time, that's what you did and that's how it worked.
Yeah.
So that bit is entirely fine. I think that's why it's the grey area.
Well, it's just the lecturers and the assistants, everyone who deals with the body selling stuff, they don't ask too much about the bodies. They don't ask for any kind of verification. It's just they buy them and they don't ask because the situation suits them and what they need. We'll get more into this later about the problems that this caused, but, you know, it's iffy.
It's icky.
Yeah.
It's icky.
So that was the first body. And another spoiler alert, it was the first of many.
I thought it was the end of the story.
No, no, this is the horrible beginning of the horrible story.
They took their £7 and retired to Barbados?
Nope. I wish they had. They did not.
Gutted.
Like every story I've told, there is some confusion over the details and the timeline, so I've gone with what I saw most often and what made the most sense.
And that makes sense.
But I like to acknowledge that some people say things happened in a different order.
Yeah.
So, Donald died in November 1827. But now we're in January-February time of 1828.
Yep.
Which is why I started the story in 1828. Because this is when the murders start.
Mm.
So the first death was in 1827. But they didn't kill Donald. He died because he was unwell. So by January-February, it's been a little bit since Burke and Hare cashed in that money. And life had continued as normal. Burke was a cobbler and Hare and Margaret were running the lodging house. You know, they'd used up the money by then.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when they had a lodger named Joseph. And again, no surname. Couldn't find one. But he was a miller. So he worked a mill. But unfortunately for Joseph, he made the ridiculous mistake of becoming seriously ill while he was staying at the lodging house.
Mm.
He came down with a really serious fever, so he was really unwell. He was delirious and, you know, he was going to die,
mm-hmm.
basically. Everyone knew he was going to die. And naturally, Hare and Margaret did what any person would do in the situation. They made everything about them. So the lodging house that they had wasn't huge, and they really crammed guests in. Mm-hmm. From some things I saw, sometimes guests would be sharing rooms, or like parties of guests would be sharing beds. So they really maxed out how many people they could charge. They, like, people were crammed in.
Mm-hmm.
which means that a guest having a really bad contagious fever would be a huge problem.
Can't just cram everyone into the room.
No, people aren't going to want to be around someone that could infect them with a fever.
So inconsiderate.
Right? How dare Joseph?
I know.
How dare God. Joseph? So this is when Burke and Hare graduate from ambitious go-getters to murderers.
Woohoo!
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
It seems like they knew that Joseph was going to die. Now, they could see that he was really unwell, but they didn't want to wait for him to die and lose out on guests staying at the lodging house and losing out on money. So Burke and Hare took advantage of how delirious Joseph was, because, you know, he was really sick.
Mm-hmm.
And they plied him with whiskey and got him very, very drunk, so that he can't see straight, like that kind of drunk. When Joseph was drunk, Hare put a pillow over his face, and Burke leaned his body on top of Joseph's abdomen.
Oh.
So, like, resting his body weight on top of him, which stopped Joseph from moving around. It stopped him from making noise, attracting attention, but it also stopped him from taking in air.
Mm.
So even if he was still managing to breathe with a pillow on his face, he couldn't inflate his lungs. So they killed him. And they stuffed him into a tea chest, just like they had with Donald, and they took him to Dr. Knox. And they got £10 for his body. About £875 today.
Oh, God.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
And they got away with it. They got away with it. Because forensic science and the way that we examine bodies today was not the same back then.
Yeah.
So their method of suffocation was basically undetectable. And nobody could really prove that they had done it. And we talk about it later. But basically, a doctor could guess that the person had been suffocated, but they couldn't prove it. So no one could prove that it was them. And then they got their money because the body wasn't damaged in any way. There were no wounds, no obvious signs of injury. There was no damage to the body. So it was perfect for dissection and perfect for study.
Well, that's what I was wondering, with the doctors having no idea. Like, well, if they, like, caved someone's skull in, and then they're like, oh, you said this man died of flu, but his skull is cracked inside out. So I was like, oh, how does that work? But that would do it.
See, there's no way to tell. Mm. And, you know, Joseph had a fever.
Yeah.
So they have a reason. He died of fever or whatever illness it was. So now they've kind of broken the seal. They've gone over into murder. They know that it works because they were able to sell the body. So they do it again.
It's interesting that they, like, step towards it. It's not just, like, not there. It's like, oh, well, this guy was dying and he owed me the debt, so I'll sell him. They're like, oh, well, this person's going to die, so we're doing him a service by we're just, like, putting him out of his misery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are pretty big steps, but even still.
Well, see, I think I mentioned it later, but it was never just because they liked killing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a business. They were selling them. They were murdering for money. It was never just to kill.
In the body business.
You know? But yeah, they did seem to graduate to this point. It didn't just happen by accident.
Yeah.
And if you remember the culture that they're coming from of grave robbing, and grave robbing isn't profitable anymore, so it seems like the logical next step to murder for science.
Yeah. But to murder the already weak and infirm and quote-unquote useless.
Well, see, we're going to talk a bit about that moving forward.
Interesting.
Their next victim was a woman called Abigail Simpson. And remember, some people give different orders of the victims, so some people say that she wasn't the next one. Mm-hmm. We're sticking with this. And I have a reason. Simpson was an elderly woman, and she was living on her pension just like Donald was. But she actually lived in a town called Gilmerton, which is to the southeast of Edinburgh. She didn't live in the city. She came into Edinburgh periodically to sell salt to add to her pension. So it was extra money for her to live on. And she sold the salt in Edinburgh. So obviously she lives outside the city. She needs somewhere to stay while she's in Edinburgh selling her salt. So where does she stay?
Oh man, this is turning into Edward Scissorhand.
Do you mean Sweeney Todd?
Oh, yes, I do. No, that's not right. This is turning into Sweeney Todd.
Uh-huh. So she stays at Hare and Margaret's lodging house because she needs somewhere to stay. And on the 12th of February, 1828, Simpson was staying at the lodging house. And weirdly, across the whole case, this is the only exact date that Burke ever gave in his confessions. Everything was kind of all over the place. He gave a couple of confessions later and some of the details changed, but this is the only exact date that he could remember.
Weird.
She's staying at the lodging house. Burke and Hare invite her to join them for drinks, which she does. And they get her very drunk, just as they had done with Joseph. And that's when they strike. Hare covered her nose and mouth with his hands, and Burke leant on top of her like he had done before. Now, I'm not really sure how people know that Hare put his hands over her face while Joseph was killed with a pillow. I'm wondering if that's a detail from the confessions, because I don't really know how they would know. But experts reckon that she was killed after Joseph because Hare used his hands. He didn't use the pillow. And it kind of suggests more confidence and more experience that this isn't their first murder. They know what they're doing. The pillow seems like an easier method.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
But this is basically how Burke and Hare would kill all of their victims. And the technique was later called burking.
Oh.
Which was when a victim was smothered and then sold for science. And this was deemed, it was called an anatomy murder. This is the type of murder that it is.
Jesus.
Isn't that awful?
That is awful.
So Simpson was stuffed into a tea chest and brought on the now familiar route to Knox's surgery. This is the third time they've done this. And once again, Knox paid them £10 for the body. And Burke said in his confession later that, quote, Dr. Knox approved of it being so fresh, but he did not ask any questions.
Well, see, that's the moral grey area is getting less grey the more these same two people appear regularly across not very long time span. Oh, we got another body. Great.
It's really fresh.
Yeah.
You think it would raise some red flags, but it doesn't. But that's why I don't believe that Knox just thought they were innocently bringing in bodies. No way.
No chance. No way.
Even when it's part of just par for the course, being brought bodies. Something would tell you that this isn't right.
Yeah. Oh, no.
So after Abigail Simpson, it was an unnamed Englishman from Cheshire. And I think this was also in February of 1828. And he was a travelling salesman staying at the lodging house. And he was selling matches and tinder in Edinburgh. And his bad luck was very similar to Joseph. He came down with jaundice while he was staying with Hare and Margaret, which basically means that you have some serious issues with your liver. It can be a really serious condition if you don't get medical help. And not wanting to lose out on earnings, Burke and Hare decided that he had to go. So they smother him, they sell him, they're in profit again.
Oh God.
And they seem to have the operation down to an art by this time. Like, they know what they're doing and they know it works.
Oh.
I told you it was going to get worse.
Yeah. Imagine them just like, oh, like, some guy in that room is really sick. And then they just look at each other and then just nod. And then one of them goes to get the whiskey.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I want to bring up at this point that Burke and Hare's wives also lived in the lodging house.
Oh yeah, you said that.
Right, they were there. They're not legally married, but they're wives. And you could argue that they were oblivious to everything because Burke and Hare were murdering these people.
It could have been.
It could be played off as just unfortunate accidents. You know, because, you know, Abigail Simpson was elderly, and these people were sick, yada yada. But whenever the men took money home, they always gave Margaret Hare, £1, which was supposed to go to the running of the lodging house. So she knew that this extra cash was coming in. So there's a monetary incentive, financial incentive.
And she's not asking questions either.
But then come the next couple of murders, which in my mind put the wives firmly under suspicion, just like Burke and Hare. I'm going to make my case, because I don't think they were innocent at all.
No, but they could have been. Like, oh, I brought some extra money, and I'm a cobbler, so I sold some shoes tonight.
Could have been. Oh, or wait. They may have believed the story that, oh, this person was just sick, they just died.
Yeah, yeah. This old person died. Oh, that's what old people do.
But I don't think so. Mm-mm. I do not think so. So yeah, I'm going to go into why I don't think they're innocent with the next murders. But this is already an hour long. So what we're going to do is we're going to leave this here. And this is going to be a two-parter episode.
Our first two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a bit of a beast.
Yeah, it's a lot. There's a lot to come. So we're going to end it here. And if you want to know the rest of the story, you're going to have to listen to our next episode. What do you think so far?
It's so horrible. I hate saying so good because it's such a good story, but it's...
It's a hard line to walk, isn't it?
Such a horrible story. Because, I would wish this story didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But...
The whole concept of... anatomy murder, like killing for science, is just quite abhorrent.
Yeah.
It's a lot to deal with, even though selling bodies for science was more normal then. It's still hard to reconcile it in your brain.
It's really weird.
Yeah.
That is a thing. Because you can still, in America, you can donate your body to, it's like the FBI or someone, and they'll bury you in a field, and then to monitor how the grass grows on top.
There's a really good book about that, about the people who study the ground, that happens when a body's buried. I can't remember. I'll have the book in the show notes. It's meant to be really, really good.
Because you told me before about how the investigators can know where there's a body buried by just looking at the ground.
Yeah.
And it's seemingly the same as all the other ground, but it isn't because the body decomposes and gives different nutrition to the soil.
It's so interesting. If you're into that. It's really, really interesting. I can't remember the name of the book off the top of my head, but I'll have it in the show notes if you're interested.
Because I don't want to.
That's fine. That's fine.
I think you can still donate your body to do that.
It would make sense.
Yeah. But I suppose now you can be an organ donor, which is similar.
Well, I think in Scotland, you're automatically opted in to be an organ donor now.
Oh, yeah, I think
you have to opt out. Which is fine.
That's a great idea.
They have it the other way around now. It makes sense.
Yeah.
But I also understand why people might not want to do that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
This is going to be a monster.
It is.
And more gore and horribleness to come in episode two. Right. Trust me, it's pretty terrible.
But do come again.
You might want to take a blanket next time, Kieran. Mm. To snuggle.
I'll get a nice hot chocolate or something. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we will see you in the next one.
We will. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.